We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. Jason Croft is at the controls. 2009 was the worst year since 9/11 for domestic terrorism. Our guest for this hour, Brian Jenkins, who is a senior advisor in the Homeland Security Program at the RAND Corporation, estimates that there have been more than 30 terrorism-related events in the United States since 9/11, and almost half of them occurred just last year. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Brian Jenkins about domestic terrorism both before and after 2001, try to take a look at why attempts trended up in 2009, and also talk about what the government is doing to try to uncover terror plots while they're still in the planning stages. And, of course, as always, as we talk with our guest, questions and comments are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That is 800-222-9455. We also will take now questions, comments by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. It would help us if you can try to keep them brief. Also, we try to ask people who are calling in to do the same, just so we can get as many callers in as possible and keep the program moving. But questions, comments from people who are listening are certainly welcome. Again, our guest this morning for this hour of Focus 580 is Brian Jenkins, and he is a senior advisor in the Homeland Security Program at RAND Corporation. He's particularly interested in the subjects of terrorism, counterinsurgency, and homeland security, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Jenkins, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us. We
Thank
appreciate
you.
It. You know, I led with this figure, these numbers about domestic terrorism, and that the reason that I did that, obviously, is it's the kind of thing that gets people's attention, and it makes for a good headline. Now, having said all that, I'm also moved to ask this question. Well, yes, it's true. Here I have in front of me an article from Time magazine, the headline, Domestic Terrorism Incidents Hit a Peak in 2009. So, as I said, that makes a good headline, but is that in fact really important?
Well, I think first let's get the right numbers.
Okay.
And let's get what we're talking about.
Okay.
And so we can make a more accurate assessment on this. When I was testifying before the Senate Homeland Security Committee, and in the back and forth of questions and answers, I had indicated that, yes, there had been a greater number of cases of radicalization and recruitment to terrorism in the United States in 2009 than in previous years. And at that time, I think I said there were 30-some, over 30, and we had seen at that time, this was as of November, 10 in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I was deluged with questions after that by many, many people, including people in the media, about, well, what is the precise number? Where, you know, and in looking about for a readily accessible chronology, didn't find one, so compiled one myself. And the accurate numbers are accurate as of the moment that we have seen 44 cases since 9/11 of radicalization and recruitment to terrorism, of which 12 occurred in 2009. Now, what do these cases include? These cases include cases where individuals or small groups plotted to carry out terrorist attacks in this country on behalf of one or another of the jihadist organizations like Al-Qaeda or Lashkar-e-Taiba in Pakistan, or where they provided direct assistance to these groups, or where they went abroad and joined these groups or attempted to join these groups. So that's what the cases include. The total number of individuals involved that have been indicted and convicted, except for several trials of the 2009 cases that are continuing. We're talking about 115 persons. Now, on the one hand, you say, gee, that's more activity in 2009 than we have seen before. What's going on? On the other hand, putting the total in context, I mean, we're talking about 115 individuals out of more than 3 million Muslim Americans, and it does not suggest that there is a deep reservoir of potential terrorists in this country. It certainly does not indicate any army of sleepers. It does not indicate that there is any terrorist underground in this country. In fact, all of these cases appear to be individual responses, small groups or individual responses, to events and to this jihadist narrative. In other words, there's no connectivity, virtually no connectivity between these various plots. The only thing we have that suggests some connectivity began in 2008, and that was the recruitment of young Somali Americans to go to Somalia to fight. And that appears to be an organized recruiting ring.
Mm-hmm. Well, this, I wonder, though, do we see any increase in attempts by terrorist organizations that are based outside of the United States to recruit people who are living in the United States, who are American citizens, either to engage in some sort of terrorist activity in the United States, or perhaps to get them to leave the country to go to another place where they can receive some training and maybe gain some experience. And we've seen it happening, as you mentioned, with these young men from Minneapolis who went to Somalia. We've also apparently seen it with some people recruited to go to Yemen. And is there some idea that, that is, these terrorist organizations have some idea that if you could recruit people who were American citizens and who had American passports, get them out of the United States, provide them with training, indoctrination, and whatever, that then it would be easier, because they are American citizens and have American passports, for them then to enter back into the United States and possibly to carry out some sort of terrorist operation in the United States?
David, you're absolutely correct. That is precisely the strategy. You have to look at where, for example, where Al-Qaeda is right now. After 9/11, as a consequence of unprecedented focus and cooperation among intelligence services and law enforcement organizations around the world, governments have managed to degrade Al-Qaeda's operational capabilities. I'm talking about their ability to plan, direct, launch significant terrorist operations, and we're talking about outside of Afghanistan, outside of Iraq. That capacity has been significantly reduced. It hasn't been eliminated. They still remain very dangerous. There are a number of now little al-Qaedas in the Maghreb, on the Arabian Peninsula, and elsewhere, where they operate more autonomously, but the center has emphasized communications. In fact, they've always believed that communications are about 90% of their struggle. And those communications really comprise constant exhortation to members of the Muslim community around the world, and especially to young men, to embrace jihad, and not jihad as a spiritual quest, but armed jihad, violent jihad. And they have increased the number of websites, chat rooms, bulletin boards that are devoted to this. These have proliferated from what was a handful at the time of 9/11 to thousands now. And in terms of English language websites devoted to these jihadist ideology, those have increased again from just a few on 9/11 to something in the hundreds right now. And that makes that message, that narrative, a lot more accessible to those who lack Arabic. In addition, there have been a number of Americans, natural native-born Americans, that have gone off, like Adam Gadan, gone off to join Al-Qaeda, who communicates through videos and on these websites in American English to Americans. Another one is Omar Hamami, who is in Somalia, again born in Alabama. Another one is the fellow that has been mentioned so frequently in the news lately, Anwar al-Awlaki, born in New Mexico, now in Yemen. And they, with their command of English, with their knowledge of American culture, have crafted this message in order to enlist young Americans.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Brian Jenkins. He is senior advisor in the Homeland Security Program at the RAND Corporation, and he's particularly interested in his research in issues of terrorism, counterinsurgency, homeland security. We're talking about domestic terrorism, some of the myths and realities, and questions certainly are welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, I know you made reference to the fact that you testified before Congress, and I know in the testimony, in recent testimony, you referred to the fact that in a previous appearance, members of Congress there made reference to the terrorist attack that had happened in Mumbai, and asked you if you thought something like that could happen in the United States. And, well, you said it could. However, you seem to also say that the likelihood was maybe not very high, and also observe the fact that what we have seen, you know, these 115 people who've been involved in incidents of domestic terrorism tend to be either individuals acting on their own or perhaps people in small groups whose effectiveness is not that they couldn't have done damage and killed people, but their potential effectiveness is kind of small. I mean, what's really the difference between something like something that's really well organized, like what happened in Mumbai, and the kinds of cases that we have seen here in the United States?
Well, you know, look at in the case of the Mumbai attack, these were 10 young men. They trained for months. They were smuggled into the city on a small boat from Pakistan. They hijacked a trawler at sea, then took that trawler, an Indian trawler, and sailed it off the waters of Mumbai, and then got into a little rubber Zodiac and landed at one of the little fishing villages in the city, and split up into a number of teams, and Each one was carrying an AK-56, an automatic weapon with over 200 rounds of ammunition. They had with them a pistol. They were carrying hand grenades. They were carrying improvised explosive devices. They were very disciplined in their operation. They went to separate points in the city, the Taj Mahal Palace Hotel, the Trident Oberoi Hotel, the Central Train Station, the Nariman Shabbat Jewish Center in the city, the Leopold Cafe, and they killed by opening fire just on people in the city. Before the episode ended, nearly 3 days later, they killed nearly 200 people. Now, could that happen here? And that was a question put to me by the senators, and I said, you know, if we're talking about something on that scale, that complexity, certainly, I won't say it couldn't, but we're not likely to see something like that in this country. Something on a much smaller scale, where one or two individuals, heavily armed, can begin shooting other people, although not in the realm of terrorism, we've seen that already. We've had these unfortunate shooting incidents, whether you're talking about a Columbine or a Virginia Tech or even some more recent episodes where two or in many cases one individual will just open fire and kill as many people as possible. There's been incidents like that, and as you well know, even more locally. So I said, that certainly is possible. Weapons are readily available. It doesn't require a great deal of training to do. It just requires an ability to obtain a weapon and make the decision to start killing. In 2009, we had two such episodes. One was a young convert to Muslim radicalized himself and opened fire on an army recruiting station in Arkansas, killing one soldier, wounding another. He wasn't terribly effective, fortunately. And then we had the more tragic episode at Fort Hood, where Major Hassan, again, a man who radicalized into this ideology, which apparently resonated with his own turmoil going on internally, and killed 13 of his fellow soldiers and wounded 31. So those episodes, in terms of active shooters, is the term the police use for it, those are entirely possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, to pick up on that for just a moment, I think that after the shootings at Fort Hood, that there were some people who very quickly wanted to label that as a case of domestic terrorism. And then there are others, and I think that you perhaps make a point like this, you made a point like this when you were talking to the members of Congress, who were saying of that particular case, the alleged shooter here, Major Hassan, while you would have to say that perhaps he was motivated in part by his political views, that in some respects what this looks like is the case, and you've touched on some others, that we have seen before, either something like Columbine or Virginia Tech, or those cases where someone who very clearly is going through great stress, maybe having issues with mental illness, one day shows up at his workplace and just starts shooting his coworkers. That you would have to say that the etiology of that, the background of that is different, that's not clearly, that's probably not a political act. Now, in the case of Major Hassan, it gets a lot more complicated. But how, I wonder, how do you sort those things out and determine to what extent something maybe is a political act and deserves to be called terrorism, and draw this distinction between that and something else?
It's a good question. You know, there's no official board of certification for labeling incidents of terrorism. And insofar as being able to untangle in an individual's mind, what is a consequence of personal difficulties versus what is a result of radicalization or political ideology, is extremely difficult to do. And we have had previous cases of terrorism where that has been a problem. In the case of when I was asked that question by one of the senators, he said, some in the media have described Major Hassan as a terrorist. Others have described him as an individual in personal crisis, dealing with personal problems. Where do you come down on that question? And I said the two really aren't mutually exclusive. Terrorism is not an activity that attracts the well-adjusted. That among the ranks of the terrorists, we often find people who have gone or are going through personal crises and find a radical ideology that resonates with those difficulties, and indeed provides direction and legitimatization for what are aggressive impulses. In the case of Major Hassan, there's no evidence of mental illness. We'll wait and see what happens at the trial. We'll know more. But there's no evidence of mental illness. There is evidence that this individual began to develop increasingly radical views, that he was, that he did correspond with the fellow I mentioned earlier, Al-Awlaki, who is a radical imam based in Yemen, that there is an indication that he knew what he was going to do. And so we have in Hassan, I'm comfortable calling it an act of terrorism. It looks a little bit like, you know, we used to call some of these episodes, putting aside the ideology, going postal. And I said, gee, in the case of Major Hassan, it was going jihad. I mean, that this ideology of violence reinforced and helped direct him in his aggressive impulses, whatever the result of that is. Now, to be able to, as I say, to be able to untangle a person's mind and say, well, which one was the greater motive, that's beyond my capacity.
One other thing here. We're getting close to our midpoint. I want to remind people who are listening, and certainly questions, comments are welcome. You mentioned the fact that here in the United States, if you look at these people who've been involved in terrorism here in the United States, that often what we're seeing here is either small groups or individuals who are deciding on their own to undertake these activities, or perhaps maybe small groups who are inspired by other organizations but aren't directed by them. It would suggest to me that if what you're talking about is groups of two or three or four people who are getting together and decide that they're going to plan an operation, or one individual that decides to do this, that then the business of trying to track these people, find out what it is that they're planning to do, and stop them before they do it, has got to be extremely difficult.
It is. We have to accept that fact. I mean, people... In the case of Major Hassan, I think there is a concern that was created that there were clues that were missed that should have alerted someone to possible trouble. But you know, when we look at many of these cases, and even putting aside the cases of terrorism, you know, a lot of these clues are obvious in a rearview mirror. But they're not so obvious when people are going through their normal lives. The fact is that if we're talking about an individual, that's an interior journey, and it's very, very difficult for anyone, certainly even for family members, but certainly for the authorities, to determine where is this individual in this interior journey toward radicalization and violence? We don't have in this country an omniscient secret police. You know, this is not East Germany where we have half the population acting as informants on the other half of the population, producing, you know, recording every remark that might indicate substandard ideological zeal or potential subversion, and with hundreds of thousands, the Stasi had hundreds of thousands of agents managing these dossiers in which all of these remarks, many of them innocent, overwhelmingly innocent, were nonetheless compiled and looked terribly serious on a piece of paper. We don't have that. And that means, in some cases, we are going to miss an individual. What's interesting, out of those 44 cases that I mentioned, the only two that succeeded in actually harming anyone else were two individuals. Where it got up to even a small conspiracy as a consequence of just a citizen's tip, a routine criminal investigation, or a confidential informant, the authorities were able to identify it and thwart the plot, and also as a consequence of simply a lot of good luck.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Brian Jenkins. He works at RAND Corporation, where he is a senior advisor in the Homeland Security Program, and he is interested in his research in subjects of terrorism, counterinsurgency, Homeland Security. We're talking here about domestic terrorism, both the myths and realities, and questions certainly are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. And that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. You may also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Certainly, if we look at the history of things that one might call terrorism here in the United States, let's just even confine ourselves to the post-war period. There have been people who have planned and carried out acts of violence motivated by some range of thoughts and political ideologies. Most recently here, maybe because of 9/11, we're focused on militant Islamists. But certainly if you look at the history of domestic terrorism in the United States, people are motivated by all sorts of things, by religious beliefs, by not religious beliefs, by politics, and you have to put in a healthy dose of mental illness in there. Do you learn anything important by trying to look at that as more of a total, picture? You know, look at the entire range.
Certainly we do. It's a good point. If we go back to the history of, let's say, contemporary terrorism, where we're really talking about an emergence of this in the 1960s. Although there are incidents of terrorism and terror campaigns that go much further back in our history. I mean, one certainly can say that the lynchings and other murders and violence carried out by the Ku Klux Klan over many decades was a campaign of terror. Mm-hmm. The Klan and other white supremacist groups, anti-federal government extremist groups like Posse Comitatus, groups like the Covenant Sword and Arm of the Lord, these emerged again as a problem in the 1980s, and of course it was the type of ideology that motivated a Timothy McVeigh to carry out the bombing in Oklahoma City in 1995, which killed 168 people, which was the worst incidence of terrorism on U.S. soil up until 9/11. So that's one continuing theme, and there still are. Today, problems in that area, threats in that area. That's one thing that people are concerned about. We go back to the late 1960s, and there was also at that time a left-wing extremism. Groups like the Red Guerrilla Family, New World Liberation Front, Weather Underground, that carried out a series of bombings. Now they spoke in a Marxist ideology, but it was primarily really began as issue driven, and the issue was opposition to the Vietnam War. In addition to those two strains on the far right and on the far left, we had a number of imported quarrels. There were Croatian separatists who carried out attacks on Yugoslav targets in this country. There were Armenians who, seeking revenge for the massacre in 1915, that carried out bombings and murders, attempted murders of individuals connected with the Turkish government in this country. There were Taiwanese separatists. There were anti-Castro extremists who carried out numerous bombings. There were Taiwanese separatists. So an array of causes that motivated. In fact, in the 1970s, the volume of terrorist violence was much greater than it is today. In the 1970s, we were averaging about 70 terrorist bombings a year in this country. We haven't seen anything. We haven't seen a fraction of that in the last 10 years.
We have a caller here we want to bring into the conversation. Again, people are welcome to join us, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi, I'm wondering if you aren't one of the terrorism experts that we have in proliferation that are actually questioning some of the basic content of the whole global war on terror. I'm thinking of like Kilcullen, who says that the drone attacks are counterproductive. He was a great advocate of counterinsurgency. He's a pretty bloody guy himself for being Australian and all. But it seems to me that, you know, by just putting it in these terms, I mean, of course we need a counter effort against cells and this sort of thing, but the strategy of attacking a whole population in the Waziristan, et cetera, creating more enemies constantly is just, it's a basis counterproductive. And we had the inkling that the GWAT was going to be, it's taken out of the discourse, but the strategies aren't that much different. So overseas contingency operations, which was the acronym the Obama administration was suggesting instead, is just so neutral to be meaningless. And it seems to me that there are analysts, and not just on the right, left, Dasovich, who just, this is, the whole premise is baseless. And the RAND Corporation even issued a study a while back that Afghanistan has no military solution, et cetera, and that we're, and I think maybe one of its suggestions was that we're just creating more enemies than we're killing. So I challenge you to respond to that point of view, and listeners to maybe look for that line of analysis, because this is a formula for perpetual war.
Certainly that is a challenge, and I don't think anyone, whatever it is called, I don't think anyone seriously believes, at least among the analysts and strategists, that there is a military solution to the problem of terrorism. I think in the period immediately after 9/11, it was necessary to go into Afghanistan to go after al-Qaeda, to disperse those training camps. Those training camps, it's not simply that they provided training, is that that was an easily accessible destination for would-be jihadists from around the world. It provided a safe haven where the operational planners for al-Qaeda could look at this continuing flow of talent coming in. And we're talking about thousands of people. And select operatives to carry out terrorist actions that really put al-Qaeda above previous terrorist organizations. I mean, these were sophisticated, large operations calculated to kill as many people as possible, and they did succeed a number of times. So something clearly had to be done about that, and insofar as a relentless pursuit of al-Qaeda and the jihadist enterprise operatives, I frankly am in favor of that. The global war on terror itself became a much more ambitious enterprise, and it encompassed not only efforts to eliminate terrorism from the world, but to go after all of the terrorist organizations in the world. In fact, I remember being at a briefing and listening to a senior State Department official being asked a question about another group, which really had not, was not involved in 9/11, and asked if they would also be on our list of targets. And he said, yes, we're going to take them all down, one after another. And I thought, oh, my gosh, that is a recipe for perpetual war. The invasion of Iraq, which was the most costly adventure, in my personal view, was a complete distraction. It had nothing to do with the war on terrorism. Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. Iraq was had no connections, really, despite claims to the contrary, with Al Qaeda. And that was a complete diversion, and that caused us to really take our eyes off the real issue was what to do about Afghanistan, and that is a problem. We do face a problem now that warfare, while we like to think of it as a finite undertaking with geographic borders, that warfare has become something much different, that is no longer confined by national borders, that there are no longer distinctions between front lines and home fronts, that certainly on the terrorist side there are no distinctions between combatants and non-combatants. And so this is something that we're coming to grips with. And that debate emerged again in the strategic discussions about how we should deal with Afghanistan. On the one hand, to simply walk away from the place and allow these groups which have expressed their hostility and acted upon it and remained determined to act upon it doesn't seem like a good idea. On the other hand, to rely solely on military power, which you are correct in pointing out, is going to create enemies in the process, because there are going to be inevitably civilian casualties, then that neither is that a solution. And so we are confronted with a true dilemma here of how do we deal with this? How do we deal with a hostile, radical threat that is located in one of the most turbulent parts of the world, and do it in a way that guarantees some modest level of stability that reduces their capabilities, but at the same time does not add to the antagonism and doesn't simply confirm their own narrative that the United States is hostile to Islam itself. Very, 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 very tough issue, and I don't think we have it entirely figured out yet. I'm not sanguine about the prospects of our forces in Afghanistan. I say that sadly as a former soldier myself. I don't think a buildup in American forces in Afghanistan, while I would say that maybe some reinforcements were necessary simply to hold on to the place to prevent further deterioration, I don't think that in the long run that a large-scale U.S. military enterprise is going to succeed. Moreover, I think some of the politically imposed timetables for that happening, and talking about, well, we're going to send them in, but we're going to start bringing them out in 18 months, I think that's also entirely unrealistic. We are looking at, when I say we, not just the United States, I think this is a global problem, looking at an imperial mission there, and that is, do we basically take this impoverished, one of the poorest countries in the world, one of the highest illiteracy rates, absent national institutions, do we take this country and basically treat it as a ward of the UN and help them govern and try to maintain some order? Do we wage endless war? Not sure what the answer is, honestly.
We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Brian Jenkins. He's senior advisor in the Homeland Security Program at the RAND Corporation. In his research, he's interested in terrorism, counterinsurgency, homeland security. We're talking about terrorism. We started out talking specifically about domestic terrorism. That is terrorist attempts to carry out terrorist acts here on the soil of the United States. And we've gotten into some other areas that certainly are connected. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455 and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a couple of callers here. People, again, will help us by trying to be brief. That way we'll get in as many as we can. We'll go next to Champaign and line one. Hello.
Good morning. Good morning.
Yes.
I'm calling you from Champaign. I began listening a little bit late. Interesting. The caller before me was accurate about everything, killings and those operations are making more enemies to United States than they help. And this gentleman from Homeland Security is making totally disservice to people being informed well about why is this war in Afghanistan. Iraq, of course, we know why, but poor country have been destroyed first by Russians and before that by English Empire. Now we are there, nothing to do. During the 9/11, the history shows that Bin Laden operated Al-Qaeda members for 1,500 people or 2,000 people against the biggest military in the world spending billions of dollars. It's kind of a funny thing to that we are threatened by 2,000 people. Of course, everybody knows that Bin Laden family had enterprises and businesses with our corporations, with Bush family, etc. But maybe this is what is necessary to this kind of a propaganda and misleading to spend $15 billion for wars and nothing for schools, nothing for social services, nothing. Why our military is not in the borders here protecting us from this terrorist threat? Why we do have to go and kill people in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Vietnam, Korea, all over? And our constitution says that our military has to be in the borders and protecting us from all of this threat.
We've got. We're getting short on time. You've raised a number of points. I want to give the guests a chance to pick among them, and you can respond to any of that that you would like.
Well, I mean, I do want to avoid conspiracy theories and propaganda debates here. The fact is that at one time the United States could rest comfortably behind broad oceans and safe from threats abroad. We have learned throughout the 20th century and into the 21st century that the idea of coastal artillery is not going to defend us against the kind of threats that we confront today, that the United States is going to have to be engaged abroad in places around the world. Now, that doesn't mean the use of military power in all cases, but that the United States is going to be engaged, and when it is not engaged, others come along and demand that it be engaged. So, for example, when the United States in the 90s initially took an aloof position regarding the situation, the deteriorating situation in the Balkans, the Europeans and the local people demanded that the United States participate, called upon U.S. participation in order to stop these massacres from taking place in Bosnia and in the Kosovo situation. So, you know, but then you become involved, and the United States gets blamed. So we are in this situation because of U.S. power, because of U.S. economic might, although that certainly is in peril right now. The United States is blamed for the world's problems. It is blamed when it tries to help solve the world's problems, and it is blamed when those solutions are not satisfactory to everybody. And that is that comes, in a sense, with U.S. role in the world. Again, doesn't always have to be a military role, but certainly the United States is going to remain involved. Insofar as a trade-off between military and schools. I mean, I think, you know, we spend, depending on who calculates, does the calculations, hundreds of billions to something in the trillions in the war in Iraq and I think that was a massive diversion of lives and treasure, and indeed ultimately impacted U.S. values itself. And that's what that's my concern, my long-term concern, is that in the course of dealing with these threats, these new challenges, that we begin to alter and erode U.S. values themselves.
I want to thank the caller. I need to go on. I want to try to get at least one more person come to a caller in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Would you comment on my impression that a major contributor to our terrorist problem, Israel's oppression of the Palestinians, specifically building on occupied territory and bulldozing Palestinian homes without compensation?
The U.S. certainly pays a price for its support of Israel. I think it is probably more the continued expansion of Israel into the territory it occupied in the 1967 war is undoubtedly a major issue. However, I think the issue there is really more fundamental than that, and that is put aside what Israel is doing recently. It is the existence of Israel itself that is offensive to the groups that have declared war on the United States. So the withdrawal of Israel from, let's say, to pre-1967 borders or the settlement of the Palestinian issue is not going to satisfy those extremists who, in fact, are calling for the annihilation of Israel itself. I think Israel's policies do create a lot of unnecessary tension, and we, as a supporter of Israel, at the same time unable to bend those policies, do pay a price for that. But change of policy is not going to reduce the hostility itself. As I say, one looks regularly at the statements made by Al-Qaeda, by these other organizations, and it is really calls for the destruction of Israel, a reestablishment of the caliphate, an expansion of their particular ideology, and as bin Laden has said himself, this clash began centuries ago and will continue until Judgment Day, or to put it in the colder words of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the operational planner behind 9/11, if, you know, we Americans are disturbed about the issue of perpetual war, but Khalid Sheikh Mohammed said, war is life. We may have degraded their operational capabilities. We haven't dented their determination one bit. This is going to go on.
We have, I'm sorry to say, about 2 minutes, and let me ask you a question that you can't really answer in 2 minutes. After the attempted bombing on Christmas Day, the airliner bombing, it became very obvious that now still, these many years after 9/11, we have serious issues when it comes to cooperation and exchange of information among the various units that make up the intelligence gathering apparatus of this country. Why is it now, all these years later, that we still have these problems with turf battles and with people sharing information?
In part, it's the nature of the business. To those involved in intelligence, sharing in many cases remains an unnatural act. But that has really improved here, and I don't think that the problem was so much not sharing information. I mean, the information was moved back from the State Department at the embassy that received the warning from Mr. Abdul Muttalib's father. It did go to the State Department. It did go to the CIA. It did move over to the National Counterterrorism Center, which is supposed to be the ultimate ultimate recipient and analyst of this information. And it was a decision made there that Mr. Abdul-Muttalib did not meet the standards for moving up to the watch list because they did not access all of the information. So we're not entirely sure here. You know, it's interesting. The White House report said it was a series of systematic errors. The president, in his own comments, said it was a systemic error. They're a failure, and those are different. And I'm not sure the problem was somebody just didn't put everything together, and it's a difficult task to do so. Intel ain't easy. Hmm. Or if there was a systemic failure, that is something inherent in the machinery or the procedures that prevented that information from moving across. And that's something that we have to look at. Unfortunately, the atmosphere that has been created is there has been a failure. Somebody must be held accountable. You know, a blood sacrifice must be made in order to appease the angry politicians and public. And I think that's an unfortunate basis for taking a cool look at what happened here. Yeah. And the reality is, you know, we're going to catch a lot of them, and occasionally it's just too doggone difficult to put everything together.
Well, there we're going to have to stop. Our guest, Brian Jenkins, is a senior advisor in the Homeland Security Program at the RAND Corporation. If you're interested in reading some of his writing or finding out more about RAND, you go to their website, which is RAND, RAND.org. Mr. Jenkins, thanks very much.
Thank you very much for the excellent questions and for the tough questions from your listeners. Thank you.